Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, January 14th, 2026, we're delighted to host a discussion on emerging issues in federal death penalty litigation. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's program, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, we will keep our introductions of our guest today brief, certainly more brief than their careers would deserve, so I highly recommend that if you're interested, you check out their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. I'll go ahead and introduce our moderator, and then I'll leave it to him to introduce our panel. Today, we are fortunate to have with us as our moderator, Jim Trustee, who after 27 years as a prosecutor, now serves as a member at IFRA Law. Prior to joining IFRA, Jim had a long career in public service, most recently as the chief of the organized crime section at the United States Department of Justice. Prior to joining DOJ, he worked as an assistant U.S. attorney in Greenbelt, Maryland, where he investigated and prosecuted a wide variety of white-collar and other criminal cases. He also prosecuted three death penalty cases and was a member of the Attorney General's Capital Review Committee, which is responsible for assessing capital-eligible cases. 2018, Jim was appointed by the Governor of Maryland to serve on the task force to study Maryland's criminal gang statutes. And I'll leave it there. Last note before I get off your screens throughout the program, if you have any questions, please do submit those via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so they'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. I'll ask that all questions submitted there, A, pertain to this discussion, and B, end with a question mark. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Jim, the floor is yours.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us, everybody. This promises to be a really informative panel. I can't tell you how excited I am to have such experience around me on this panel. I'll give you an introduction about each of them here in just a second. But let me start with also just thanking John Richter from King and Spalding and a Federalist Society member who kind of got the ball rolling and hooked me up with these guys and gave us some ideas of topics. So I'll start with the introduction, then I'll tell you a little bit about where this is going to go today, and then I'll hopefully step out of the way mostly. We have panelists to start with is Steve Mellon, who's a recently retired federal prosecutor who served at DOJ and various U.S. attorney's offices for over 30 years. His career focused on violent crime, terrorism, death penalty cases. He was one of the prosecutors on the Zarniev case, the Boston Marathon bomber case, which logically brings us to David Bruck. David Bruck is a longtime defense attorney that's been involved, really devoted a career to dealing with death penalty type cases. He was one of the attorneys for Mr. Zarniev in the Boston Marathon bomber case, and also represented Dylan Roop from the Charleston church shooting case, if you remember that, and Susan Smith. And David, make me feel old. How long ago was Susan Smith? Was that the 90s?
That was 30 years ago, 1990.
Yeah, man. Okay. And so I remember it. It tells you something about, you know, my age. But anyway, real high profile case back in the day. And David more recently has just retired from being a professor at Washington and Lee Law School and devoting a whole bunch of time to representing an individual at Guantanamo Bay. Johnny Sutton, our third panelist, was an assistant district attorney in Harris County, Texas, from 1988 to 1995. He tried 17 different murder cases, including seven that were actually capital trials. He became the U.S. attorney in the Western District of Texas in 2001 through 2009. And if you think that he's coming because he's from Texas, if you think he's coming from the right, let me let you know he was the left fielder for the University of Texas championship baseball team in 1983. Hokum Horns, as seemingly is making the rounds here. And David currently handles a wide variety of criminal and regulatory matters at Ashcroft, Sutton, Rays. So that's a very thin version. Again, check the links if you want to impress yourself with the much deeper assessment of these guys' careers. But they are certainly folks that are in the know when it comes to the death penalty and some of the trends and changes that we're seeing. In terms of the topic, let me just identify a few things off the top. I mean, the first thing is we're really not here to give a long-winded long-winded account of whether we think the death penalty is good, bad, indifferent, religious, hateful. You know, it's not a philosophical webinar. We're going to try to focus on what we're seeing out there, what some of the big issues are in death penalty litigation, and some of the tactics that are engaged in by the prosecution and the defense. I want to start with a little bit of data because it's going to feed into some of these questions about the trend. And first, we'll start with the state side. On the state side of death penalty prosecutions in 2025, we had 47 executions spanning 11 states. Those states were led by Florida with 19, Texas with 5. There was 5 in South Carolina, including 3 by firing squad, which I never thought I'd be saying in a webinar. But 3 and by firing squad, that's the first time we've had that manner of execution since 2010. Last year, 2025, on the state side, 23 individuals were sentenced to death. And by way of comparison, 30 years ago, 1995, we had about 300 sentenced to death across the country in state court. So obviously, big change in numbers. On the federal side, in 2024, we had 26 new federal death penalties imposed. But then when we got to about Christmas, or I think it was December 23rd, President Biden commuted the death penalty to life without parole, announced a moratorium on seeking the death penalty, with the exception of 3 defendants who were on death row. And that's Tsarnaev, who we mentioned from the Boston Marathon bomber, the Charleston church shooting, and the Pittsburgh synagogue killings. And so those individuals stayed on federal death row. As you know, President Trump took office 2025. Attorney General Bondi reversed the moratorium, reversed a lot of the kind of internal protocol that was imposed by the Biden administration. And in 2025 and the 2026, the only 2 federal cases that I'm aware of, and I think this is accurate, for seeking the death penalty. And we always talk about seek or no seek in this lane, so get used to that language. The 2 seeks, one was Luigi Mangione from the high-profile New York murder of a healthcare executive, and we'll talk a little bit about that case specifically later. And an individual named Jasper Reed from the Western District of Oklahoma. Reed was a felon in possession, serving a sentence for a felon in possession case. Tried to strangle his cellmate, who survived. Prison moved him to another cell, and he successfully strangled the cellmate at the second cell. So that's another one where there's been some sort of formal acknowledgement by the administration that they're seeking. There were no federal executions that actually took place in 2025, but as you can tell from what I just talked about, it's been a little topsy-turvy in terms of the changing administrations and predicting the timing of anything. So that's kind of some factual data, which I'm going to jump back to in a second. Real quick, I want to talk about the basic process that we go through for these death penalty cases. You know, they arise when agents bring a case to a U.S. attorney's office anywhere in the country. The U.S. attorney's offices all have their own internal protocol of sitting down and figuring out and papering whether or not they think it's a case where they should seek or not seek the death penalty. And once they've done that, they communicate that that document or series of documents to the Capital Case Unit, which is a small main justice unit of specialists that deal with capital crimes, although they are supplemented by the Attorney General's Review Committee, which is a whole bunch of attorneys across the country that have experience in death penalty cases. So they kind of supplement their ranks. And what they'll do is assess the presentation, the information from the U.S. Attorney's Office, invite any sort of mitigation or interesting information the defense wants to provide, which, again, is a subtopic we'll come back to. And they make a recommendation to the Attorney General. Once it goes to the Attorney General, that Attorney General makes a decision, and everyone marches off to war, either for a no-seek or a seek case at that point. The Attorney General is the bottom line in terms of federal prosecution. So that's some process. Just wanted to make sure people that don't practice in this lane had a little bit of an idea of how this stuff works. And let's circle back to the fluctuating numbers, the dramatically fluctuating numbers. You know, and I guess the first question is, what explains that? Why are we seeing such a precipitous decline overall in death penalty prosecutions and successful death penalty prosecutions? And I'll start with David, and then we'll hear from some other folks as well. So what's your belief in terms of what's going on with the general decline across the country, David?
Well, like for a lot of things, there are a lot of reasons, but there's been a decline in homicides and in violent crime generally, a very marked decline over the last 20 years or so. That plays into it. There is a life without parole option, which never existed in most places until about 20, 30 years ago. So both prosecutors and sentencers now have the alternative of imposing a true life sentence, which was not generally true back in the 90s when you were seeing 300 death sentences in a single year. There's been a big improvement in the quality of defense representation and in the resources available. There's still a long way to go, but compared to when I started out in South Carolina, the fees for a defense lawyer were capped at $750 per case at $10 an hour out of court, $15 in court. And in case you got too greedy, there was a $750 limit. In other words, capital representation was pro bono to all intents and purposes. And that was true in most of the states that use the death penalty. There's been a big change in the professionalization of the defense bar, and that's made a big difference. But I think maybe the biggest factor of all is that there's just been a big decline in the popularity of capital punishment. It used to run around 80% in the Gallup polls, and it's down to around 50. At that level, you really are not going to get death sentences in any appreciable number. And that, I think, more than anything, explains why there's been a 90% decline. This is in this goes along with the trend throughout every Western democracy, all of which have abolished the death penalty except for us. And I think if you just look at this objectively, I think this is a punishment that is obsolescent and disappearing, and that's likely to continue. There's some ups and downs, but generally that's where we're headed.
I want to come back to one of the things you mentioned, which was the availability of life without parole in a sec. But Johnny, do you have thoughts either that track or diverge or contradict what we just heard from Professor Brock?
I agree with most of that. Maybe not the popularity part. I think those polls are kind of tricky. You know, if in a generic question about the death penalty, it's a little over 50%, but then you actually kind of lay out the facts of what someone did, and then the poll changes dramatically. Well, you know, for that, obviously, I'd want the death penalty. I think there's a little bit of flex there, but I agree with most of that. I grew up in Houston, Texas, born and raised there, and I sort of lived, through a lot of this death penalty action, both just growing up in a very, very dangerous city. And back in those days, my senior year of high school, there were 740 murders in Houston, and it wasn't that big a town in those days. It was about 850,000, which is not small, but today it's over 5 million. And there's only, I think the number is, 320 murders. So the town has grown by millions, and the murder rate has gone way, way down. So I think that's a very big part of it, is we just are not seeing crime. This new generation just has no idea how bad crime was in the 70s and early 80s and early 90s. And those drops were dramatic. And we can talk about why that occurred. But when I joined the DA's office and started trying cases in 1988, that was sort of at the heart of the, juries and people were just sick and tired of the murders and the robberies and the kidnappings, and they wanted something done. Plus, the prison had a revolving door, at least in Texas. If you got a 10-year sentence, you were out in 10 months. And a lot of that, I think, contributed to frustration of the community, and juries were very upset about it. And when they were picked on a capital murder case, they almost always brought back the death penalty in those days.
Really interesting. Steve, anything you wanted to add to that, or should I move on to the life without parole?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with David regarding the trends, but I think really kind of this is driven somewhat by social media and the Innocence Project. I think the Innocence Project has done a really good job of kind of finding the cases that were out there that were wrongly prosecuted. And social media now has really brought that to light. And so the people across the United States are more aware of these death penalty concerns and concerns about is there a possibility someone is being prosecuted when they didn't actually commit the crime? So I think that's a big part of it. I also think activist judges are a big part of it, at least on the federal side. I can't really speak to the state side, But on the federal side, there are a number of judges who are anti-death penalty, and they're on either the district court level or the court of appeals level. And when they get these cases, they hold prosecutors to an impossible task of having a perfect trial. And so that requires either a prosecutor to become perfect, which is, as you know, Jim, never going to happen, or if the cost is just too high to U.S. attorney's offices and the Department of Justice to try to prosecute these cases. And so you really are finding that we only go after the worst of the worst of the worst. And just a quick comment on life without parole. I know David thinks that's kind of out there, and I've heard David argue in other cases about how heinous that is to these defendants and how they're going to be thrown into a dungeon and they'll never see the light of day again. And that's not the case in federal court. And the other thing about life without parole, when President Biden commuted 37 of the 40 people on death row, 11 of those 37 defendants had done a killing or ordered a killing while incarcerated. So just like this Reed case you just talked about, Jim, you have 11 people who have killed from jail. So the belief that life without parole will save the society and we will all be protected from these evil people is just incorrect.
Yeah, I'm still reeling from your suggestion that I was not a perfect prosecutor, but I will move on a little bit, which is, I mean, let's just be clear for our audience that I view life without parole as a, you know, alternative to the death penalty as a factor both in the early stages of a case when the defense is talking to the prosecution about whether to seek or not. And obviously it's going to factor into the consideration of the attorney general. Like, is this sufficient as a life without parole case? And it's usually that stark a dichotomy. It's either one or the other. Occasionally you talk about a term of years, but it's usually one or the other of those. But I also think of it in terms of this thing we call the ADX defense. And maybe, again, as something that's presented to juries at trial, I think that David made the point that traditionally or historically, a lot of death penalty juries were not hearing about the alternative that would be imposed if they didn't impose a death penalty. In other words, they weren't told that if we convict of these crimes that we've already convicted on, he's already getting life without parole. And so this has kind of morphed into something more regularly a part of the death penalty defense now, which is this ADX defense. So maybe, David, if you could just give us a quick definition of what that is and whether you think that's something that has contributed to the overall decline of death penalties obtained.
It's not something that's not a term that defense attorneys use, but I think what you're referring to is to try to impress on the jury the ways that prisons and that the federal prison system can confine indefinitely someone who the system itself regards as dangerous. And ADX, of course, is the supermax prison out in Colorado where people can be confined and are confined under very, very stringent conditions. It's nevertheless true, and Steve was very good at that when I watched him do it, at creating a doubt about, in almost any case, about whether someone will really be locked down tight, you know, forever. It's significant, I think, if you left this issue up to prison wardens, you'd find very little support for the death penalty, even though what Steve says is true about all the number of folks who committed their crimes in prison. But by and large, this is not a tool. The death penalty is not a tool that looms very large, if at all, in the arsenal of prison wardens. Of course, they're not the ones that make the decision. To portray this as something that we sort of have no, is that there are people that are like nuclear waste or that you just, you know, there's no safe place to put them. I don't know that it really matches the experience of folks that actually run prisons.
And Johnny or Steve I know from back in my days, I would occasionally have this as a mitigator. You know, juries are called upon in death penalty trials to weigh aggravating factors and mitigating factors. And some of that's statutorily defined, and some of it's kind of left open to the creativity with, you know, rail guards of the judge. to decide whether it's a factor that should be considered. And I know that I ran into, and this was in Maryland primarily, ran into this, we called it the ADX defense, but essentially a presentation for the jury about the strictures of being in a supermax and how the daily controls are severe, and even the size of the cell. Like, they would literally mark off on the floor of the well of the courtroom, like, how small it is, to impress upon the jury that it's okay not to impose death because he's going to suffer for a long, long time. I mean, did you guys run into that as an affirmative, as not a subliminal, but as an actual part of the defense case in some of your cases?
Johnny, you go first.
Steve, you know this better, but I've got on life without parole for sure. But go ahead, Steve. Go first, please.
Yeah, go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, yes, Jim. I mean, that comes up now all the time in every federal death penalty case. That's one of the biggest defenses out there, that we can lock them up and throw away the key and you'll never be heard from again. And that's just not true, but that's the argument Mr. Bruck and others make. To try to convince a jury that society is safe from these people. I can tell you for a fact that one of the cases I did was Kabani Savage, and Mr. Savage was in jail in Philadelphia when he called out the bombing of a row home in Philadelphia, which resulted in the death of 6 people, 2 adults and 4 children burned to death. So, I mean, there are always concerns. Wardens love to say that they can control everyone. Wardens make mistakes every single day. So, I mean, I don't think we can rely on that. I think it's a question of we as a society, we decided these people have committed such cruel and heinous acts that they have essentially given up their rights to exist in a civilized society.
Gotcha. Before, and I want to come back to talking about the importance of victims, the nature of the victims' families. We'll get to that in just a sec. But while we're kind of floating out some of these typical defenses that we're seeing, and again, in the context of them being part of the explanation, perhaps, for less success or less numbers of death penalty prosecutions, I want to just touch on intellectual disability for a second as well. You know, we had Supreme Court jurisprudence. We have a lot of Eighth Amendment, typically case law that comes out of the Supreme Court. And the Eighth Amendment is a fluid concept, you know, where we're kind of looking at the mores of our current society and figuring out what can we live with or not live with. We've had that kick in terms of not executing juveniles. And we've had that kick in with this concept of intellectual disability. So I guess, again, I'll start with David, because I know you've raised this in some cases. What is intellectual disability for purposes of death penalty litigation, and how frequently is it really available to you?
Well, it's, of course, the old term was mental retardation, which has now been replaced by intellectual disability. It means exactly the same thing. And it basically means that you have to have an IQ in or below the bottom 3% of the population, and it has to have real world effects that you, in your ability to function in society without supports. It has given rise to a fair amount of litigation. Typically, the people who are functional enough to even get themselves in this kind of trouble are going to be at the upper level, close to the borderline of mental retardation, of intellectual disability. And that's why, there tends to be some knockdown, dragout battle of the experts about whether someone falls on one side of the line or the other. And under the Eighth Amendment, the Supreme Court ruled back in 2002 that it does violate the Constitution to execute somebody who is at this very, very bottom level of intellectual functioning, which, if you think about it, makes some sense, because if you have a punishment that is only imposed on the guiltiest, most morally blameworthy 1% of the population or 2% of the homicide, the homicide defendants, is it even really possible that someone could both be in that top tiny sliver moral blameworthiness, and also in the bottom 2% of intellectual functioning? The Supreme Court's answer, in effect, was no, it's really not possible, though. That's a Venn diagram that doesn't overlap. But it, you can state the issue fairly simply, but actually establishing what side of the line somebody falls on, it can be mind-numbingly complex. Without going into it at all, I find it sort of frustrating that in the end, we really are arguing if whether someone's in the bottom 3% or whether they're in the bottom 5%. Should it really make that big a difference? The difference between life and death. And to what extent is the difference important enough to devote the federal courts or the state courts to this very, very complicated litigation when you have the alternative of life and life without parole as a punishment to begin with?
Well, I don't want to wax too philosophical, but I will say that in terms of, from the prosecution perspective, you mentioned that it's usually this drawn out battle of experts, perhaps more than one, to set that all in motion. And I assume the best case for the defense is pre-existing evidence prior to the case of that level of impairment, school records, et cetera. But I always found that, you know, from, again, this probably goes back to my state practice, that just good premeditative facts tend to eliminate these types of defenses. Like if you can show concerted conduct, pre-arming, having a motive, fleeing the crime, there's a whole bunch of kind of, you know, executive functions that tend to hurt the defense on that. In the absence of a really, you know, slam dunk long history of impairment. Johnny, I don't know if you had anything you wanted to add to that in terms of, you know, seeing in terms of the success of that defense.
I just had many, many battles with psychiatrists who had, you know, maybe spent 3 or 4 hours with the defendant in a jail cell and now are pontificating about things. And my experience is the same as yours, which is the street IQ is much higher than the IQ that's on the test, and that the evidence of their ability to operate on the street and, you know what they're doing and wrong and how to cover it up and how to plan it is usually there, and it usually defeats that pretty easy. And by the way, just I wanted to say just a quick word about life without parole, if I could. When I left the DA's office to go work for the Texas governor, you know, I was basically in the governor's representative to all the prisons. And I immediately reached out and started learning about the prisons. And, you know, we have a bunch of, you know, over 100 units. I think at that time we had 140,000 prisoners. And one of the things I wanted to know is how many people were actually doing long life sentences. And I asked them, and this is 1995, I said, how many people in Texas prisons right now have been in prison continuously for over 30 calendar years? And they came back with some numbers that were completely wrong. I said, no, they can't have gotten out and gone back in. They cannot have gotten out. And we finally got that number scrubbed to the correct number. It was 11 people of 150,000 that had been in there for 30 years. And what I realized is we don't have a lot of experience in life without parole and what that means. I mean, because we just, and no one even, when I spent time in Texas prisons, you know, I'm thinking, you know, a 17-year-old is coming in here with a life without, it's usually a life 40, and then we're going to consider maybe they'd be up for parole. And people are acting like that's not a lot of time. I mean, it's an insane amount of time, but I really doubt that our promises that we're making to victims today that he's never going to get out of prison are false, because 40 and 50 and 60 years in the future politicians are going to say, we're not going to pay for this. Everybody's going to be gone, and they're going to change that law and let him out. So I just want to make that point. I don't think we've ever seen it, or very rarely.
Well, I got visions of Shawshank Redemption going through my head now. Thanks for that. But it's a good segue into talking a little bit about victims, because and I use the word victim, not necessarily meaning literally the person that was killed. But when we talk about victims in the criminal justice system of litigating death penalty, we're talking about their family, their loved ones. And I guess I'm kind of curious from your all's perspective. I'll start with Steve. How important is the victim's family's position on the death penalty to this process? I mean, to the individual AUSA, but also just as it goes through the process of getting up to the attorney general, how much weight? Because obviously prosecutors aren't plaintiff's attorneys, but there's also a victim bill of rights, and there's all sorts of built-in, you know, expectations that the victim's voices will be heard in a capital case or capital eligible case as much as anything. So what's your expectation in terms of how it's worked out with victims' voices, and where you think it's going in current days?
you know, Jim, you laid out the process that you go through to go to the capital case unit and have the attorney general make a determination. And the victim's family members, and if they're survivors, like in Boston, there were a lot of amputee survivors that weighed in as well. Their opinions are considered, but they are not the deciding factor. I mean, the deciding factor is going to be that aggravating factors of how heinous was this, how much premeditation was there a grave risk of death to a lot of other people? So in the end, it's not going to really change the result. But I can tell you, like in a mass bombing like Boston, you've got a real split with the victims and the survivors. Some want to seek the death penalty, some do not want to seek the death penalty. So ultimately, and I just want this group to understand, ultimately, the decision is made not by the attorney general. The decision is made by the jury, because the jury then has to decide unanimously between life imprisonment or the death penalty. So it's a call really to the conscience of the people as to what is the appropriate punishment. But the victims' family members all matter, especially, as you know, Jim, if you're the AUSA on the case or the trial attorney, because you're working with them day in and day out. And they're expressing their opinions to you all of the time. And David knows from Boston that the Richard family was very much anti-death penalty, and that yet their son was the 8-year-old little boy who was killed. And so we had to deal with that throughout the trial. You know, it's a very tough situation. I will say one other thing about President Biden's commutations. He commuted those 37 death verdicts without ever once talking to any family member on any of those 37 cases. And as a prosecutor who had to deal with those family members, I was just so angry that that's the way in which that was handled.
Yep. So I'll steal David's thunder for a second, which is, with, from my knowledge, in the Charleston church shooting, you know, you had a whole bunch of victims and survivors that were extremely religious folks. I mean, almost by definition. And they, some of them forgave him from day one. Some of them would eventually change their mind when they heard about a manifesto in jail and talks about race wars. And so it's a very, I think it's a very emotional, spiritual, and fluid situation for a lot of victims in terms of you know, what their decision making is. I think there was a state prosecutor who was asked, why aren't we listening more to these victims? And she said something to the effect of, we don't put that burden on them. You know, as a representative of the community, it's the prosecutor that's got to navigate this territory, which can be very difficult if they expect death and you're not seeking it, or if they're against the death penalty and you are. There's a lot of internal, I think Steve touched on this, a lot of challenges to that situation. And I guess, Johnny, from your perspective, because you guys were, you know, a mill at, for a period of time there in Texas, dealing with, you know, 740 murders or whatever. Did you have situations where you were really at odds with the victims in either direction? And again, from both the state and federal side, what's your feel for how important the victims are? And by the way, I would just mention for our viewers, like, think about Erica Kirk, right? I mean, Charlie Kirk's wife announced very early into this that she forgives him. And the question becomes, like, how much is that going to matter in this process, and how difficult is it to navigate?
Yeah, I mean, it's it matters, but I don't think it matters that much. I mean, I guess it's possible that Charlie Kirk's widow could be, you know, testifying in punishment that she doesn't want the death sentence, but I doubt that is going to happen. These are Christians who are making sort of a personal forgiveness and letting things happen the way they should. So we considered it, but I mean, it's the state of Texas versus the defendant of the United States against this defendant, and they're, you know, much bigger policy and case related decisions that have to be made. So it matters, but I'm not going to make the decision, or our office wouldn't, based on just what they wanted.
If the decision's been made, hold on one second, Dave. If the decision's been made to seek, there's a death penalty trial, and the defense either knows or is made aware of the fact that victims' family members are against the death penalty, does the defense ever call these witnesses or ring out some sort of stipulation as part of the penalty phase?
They're not allowed to. And David, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead, Dave.
The Supreme Court has said that victims' opinions about what punishment should be imposed is inadmissible. That came up in the context of victim family members who wanted the death penalty, but courts have uniformly applied that in both directions. So that would not happen. I want to put a little of this sort of what about the victims perspective, because we had about 19 or 18,000 murders in the United States last year, and that's way down, but it's still a lot. And we've had 47 executions, and there are going to be far fewer executions in the years to come because the pipeline is not being filled up anymore. We've gone from 300 death sentences a year. That's where that 300 is where those 47 executions came from. Those people have been on death row for 10, 20, 30, even 40 years before they were executed. Now we're putting, last year there were 23 death sentences. So that's putting new cases into the pipeline. And in a few years, there will be almost no executions, no matter what people think about the death penalty, because that's the way the system is operating. At the same time, in some way, the system tells murder victims' family members that the way the law shows its respect and values your loss and takes what you have gone through seriously is with the death penalty, or at least that's an option, when it's almost never. I mean, if that's the script, if that's the coin of the realm for avenging or for showing that we take a murder seriously, it is almost never received by victims' family members. And so you have to ask, like, what does that tell the 19,000 minus 20 family members of murder victims who did not receive that for whatever it was worth? And I've seen this play out in so many ways. I mean, in Charleston, there were family members of those people that were murdered in that church who really felt that they weren't for the death penalty, but they couldn't tolerate the idea that the system would not treat the murders that had occurred there seriously. And the definition of seriously was the death penalty. Why should that be when almost no one is actually sentenced to death? We're at a level of, this is purely symbolic. It has no actual practical real world significance anymore. And this is the message that we are unintentionally sending. So it's a real policy issue that I think has to be looked at a lot more soberly than okay. We have been doing.
Let me jump in. I want to do a real quick, I want to get to some observations you guys might have about the Mangione case and what that means as to the administration's very early announcement, et cetera. But just a real quick hot potato round robin, maybe it's an unfair question to do that quickly, but what about the issue of the victim's conduct? And I don't mean the victim's families. Now I mean the victim himself or herself. A lot of the cases that are death eligible involve people that are involved in bad things themselves. The victims might be gang members, and it's some sort of ongoing dispute between gangs. How much does that factor into, you know, we can spend a lot of time talking about how the jury views it, but how does that factor into the seek, no seek decision? Is it something that a U.S. attorney's office can convince an attorney general, hey, we're never going to get it because this person was in MS-13 or whatever? Do you have experience with that? And again, I want to keep it pretty short just so we can spend a couple minutes on Mangione and then have some other questions. So I'll start with Johnny.
Yeah, I mean, I had some, you know, unusual experience in this because I came out of Harris County, probably the most aggressive prosecution office in the, you know, the modern America on death sentences. And we knew how to evaluate a death case. When I was a district court chief down there, I probably saw in my court alone 8 to 10 death eligible capital total murders. And I would usually seek zero or one death sentence per year, because most of those were not, even though they were death eligible cases, we knew immediately they were not death penalty cases. And when I got to the Deputy Attorney General's office and worked up there and worked with closely with the capital case unit, and a lot of those cases where I was kind of working both ways, because I knew that capital case unit chief very well. And I was just shocked at some of the discussions we were having about cases that were absolutely no-brainers for non-death. And we are having a discussion about it. And it's like, well, we have to treat all victims the same. And, you know, a bunch of crack dealers on a street corner fighting for their crack corner in North Carolina is not the same as, someone who's executed by Mangione or some kidnapping and brutal murder of little girls. I mean, And the problem with that, it would sort of lift everything up, as opposed to, wait a minute, we're going to pick out the true death sentences where we're 100% convinced on guilt and we know we're going to get it. And that's it.
Jim, I do need to correct a statistic. Attorney General Bondi has now authorized the death penalty in her first year in about 24 cases. Mangione was the first. But there have been quite an onslaught of Sikh decisions by this attorney general since then, including 7 or 8 cases that were actually no Sikhs under the Biden administration. And they are revisiting those and digging them back up and saying they're going to be Sikhs after all. And now the courts are getting involved. So there's been a great deal of activity.
That's super interesting.
Yeah, the number under Attorney General Sessions at the same point after 1 year was one case. And for Attorney General Bondi, it's 24, a huge difference.
Yeah, that's newsworthy. David, is just kind of pivoting on the same issue of dirty hands, whatever you want to call it, in terms of the victim. Is that something that becomes a part of any defense presentation to convince prosecutors not to seek? Like, do you focus much on that, or do you feel like they'll have to do their own assessment of their chances of getting the death penalty in this scenario?
Well, it's a statutory mitigating factor that the victim bears some responsibility for. So sure, that'll be pointed out. But I also have to point out that this whole idea of looking at sort of nobody much got killed, I don't mean to be disrespectful about that, but that kind of is how the sort of courthouse work group will look at a case. Is also an avenue for which a lot of invidious discrimination can creep in, race, ethnicity, social class, in a way that we can all be unconscious of. And then the statistics come out and we say, gosh, there really is a big disparity by race or ethnicity, or most certainly by class. So this is a very tricky business. And it's one of those things, again, there are huge arguments about how real the statistics of discrimination are and whether they're more apparent than real and all of that. But it's undeniable that the system puts its moral chips on the table when they make these decisions. And the question is the game worth the candle?
Gotcha. I want to build in a couple of minutes to talk about Mangione, since we promised it. And we're not talking about Chuck Mangione, Steve. We're talking about Luigi Mangione. Again, let's try to not get too philosophical, but just observations about a case where, and I don't know the timing of these other 23, but with the Attorney General Bondi, the timing of the announcement was within, I think, days of his apprehension. So clearly you had the top of the communications of these decisions announcing it, long before there was any defense presentation of mitigation, if there was going to be one, long before there was any kind of paper trail of Southern District prosecutors announcing, what their thoughts were. Do you think this portends anything with the current administration in terms of how death penalty protocol is going to go? And I'll start with you, Johnny, but I'll hit everybody.
Yeah, those are those are tough. And I've been in that position many times where the case is so high profile and there's such a scream from the public that the elected really has to do or say something. And of course, I would always be saying, wait a minute, you know, President Trump is going to be the one deciding whether this guy gets commuted down the road from his death sentence when he gets it. So we probably shouldn't even comment until the investigation is done. But I understand the political pressure in these, you know, dramatic, horrifying killings like this. And, you know, I saw it in the James Byrd dragging death down in Jasper. You know, that was just a horrific killing in Texas back in the late 90s where, you know, a black man was dragged to death behind a pickup truck by, you know, three white guys in East Texas. And it was, you know, the outrage was unbelievable. And, you know, Governor Bush, then Governor Bush at the time, said, we're going to seek the death penalty. It just happens. It's not ideal, but I think it's just part of the deal, and the process gets a little bit. I mean, I prefer no one to comment until an investigation is done, but politics makes that almost impossible sometimes.
Yeah. Steve, any quick thoughts on where we are with the current administration and the protocol?
Yeah, I agree with Johnny. I mean, I think that some of these things are so political and so in the, you know, current social media light that there are comments going to be made. That doesn't necessarily stop anything, and nor does it necessarily prejudice anything down the road. But, you know, I think that now Attorney General Bondi is learning to go ahead and kind of maybe not say as much and go ahead and hold the thoughts close until the whole process plays itself out. I think it's wiser for the U.S. Attorney's Office that way. I think it's wiser for the Department of Justice for that to play out as well.
David, quick pivot on this, but the same topic. Do you find, you know, when the defense is invited to make a presentation to Capital Case Unit, which is something that regularly happened, and you come in and you might, if you have some smoking gun about guilt or innocence, you might play that card. If you have something about intellectual disability that's really strong, maybe. But when you see these moments of kind of high profile, quick decisions, does that impact your decision-making about whether or not it's worth sharing things with the prosecution? You know, if you could give us a quick glimpse into that.
Well, sure. I mean, the prosecution has a very valuable tool in the protocol process because they invite the defense in to basically say, why shouldn't we seek the death penalty? And that's a lot of free discovery for the government if the government avails himself of it. But if the attorney general takes the attitude that we already know everything we need to know, then defense counsel would not be very well advised to show anything because the decision's already been made and it's not going to have any effect. So there have been, of those 23 or 24 Sikh decisions that Attorney General Bondi has made, several of them have been made with bypassing the protocol entirely and not hearing from anybody. That does not, I mean, I'm not a prosecutor and I shouldn't be, I don't advise the Justice Department about how to do its prosecuting, but that does not seem like a very smart approach.
I was a prosecutor and I did work for the federal government, and I agree with David, that's not a wise
approach. Gotcha. All right, I want to leave some minutes for the audience having questions, but I want to give you guys each a chance to kind of do a little bit of a wrap up in terms of, you know, where the state of the death penalty and where you see things going. And, you know, one thing we didn't really touch on, which I'll just mention as something you might want to incorporate or not into your comments, is that, you know, we had a Supreme Court case that basically said that in cases where there was not an intent to kill or a death, that it's wrong for states to pursue the death penalty. And you've had other ones over the years that talk about the need for unanimity on the penalty phase from the jury to allow for the death penalty. But we've got some action on the state level that's very interesting. In an era of declining death penalties, you've got a couple of states. Florida passed a law in 2023 that allows for a judge to impose death with 8-4 or better as the split for death. And Alabama has a 10-2 split, same thing. So non-unanimous jury verdicts. I think these were both in response to the Parkland school shooting. And the case that started all this, Kennedy versus Louisiana, the majority in that case saying we're not going to let death penalty go to non-death scenarios are all gone. It's Kennedy, Stevens, Souter, Ginsburg, Breyer, the dissent, Alito, Roberts, Scalia, and Thomas. So if you're a betting person and this case comes back up, it could be very interesting. So anyway, I just wanted to throw that out as a quick nod to what's happening on the state side, or at least in some states, and then see if you guys had some kind of wrap up thoughts about, you know, protocol and process and the future of the death penalty, or at least the near future of the death penalty as we're riding through the Trump years. And I'll start with Steve and we'll just bounce around, but go ahead, Steve.
I mean, I think that as to the future of the death penalty, I agree the trend is down, but I do think that there's always going to be these evil acts done by individuals that are going to, in everyone's mind, kind of lead to the conclusion that the death penalty is appropriate. So I think that the numbers will be down, but I think you're still going to always have that as a possibility. I think it's probably unwise to have less than unanimity in any of these cases. I think those states that are allowing that are inviting an appeal of the Supreme Court. It just strikes me that I was in the federal system and we were required to have unanimity, and that didn't stop us from doing our job. So I think it's really unwise for the states to not require unanimity in something as drastic and dramatic as the death penalty.
All right, very good. And, you know, before I turn to you, Johnny, kind of implicit in the whole conversation today is the idea of this pyramid of death eligible cases. And what we're really talking about in some ways is, where exactly do you draw the line at the very top, the apex, to determine which are the worst of the worst? And over time, that seems to change, where a flood of murders in Houston, or Washington, D.C., for that matter, maybe moves the line down, because of public pressure and because of the sheer horror of having hundreds and hundreds or even thousands of murders in a particular location. But I'm also hearing, you know, from all three of you that you respect the notion that it should be somewhere high, you know, that we should have kind of internally a high burden of proof, maybe beyond a reasonable doubt burden, and that it should be reserved for the worst of the worst. But anyway, just a quick observation from what you guys have been talking about. Johnny, take it from there.
I wouldn't let you change the burden of proof, but I totally agree this should be something reserved for the worst of the worst that you're 100% sure on and you can prove future danger. Let me defend Harris County for a second. That's the DA's office in Houston. And I think there's maybe 298 Harris County inmates that were sentenced to death from Harris County, by far the most in the country of any county that I'm aware of, at least in modern times. And one of the reasons for that is everyone knew how to try these cases. Many of the defense lawyers had tried 8, 9, 10, 12, sometimes 15 capital murders, both for death, as prosecutors, and then as defense attorneys. So they were extremely experienced defense attorneys doing these cases, extremely experienced prosecutors, and most time the judges had tried these cases, both as prosecutors and defense attorneys, and many as judges. So we knew how to do it. I think one of the problems is most folks do not know how to do this. David is one of the most rare lawyers in the world to have the kind of experience that he has. And most lawyers are absolutely terrified of the idea of being involved in the case. Like, it's one of the most important things government does, because we're going to be taking a person's life if it ends up they're convicted and the appeal is held. So I think the death penalty is down because crime is down and experience is down and people are nervous about it, but it is not going away. I had cases in Houston where the liberals in the courthouse who hated the death penalty would secretly come and whisper in my ear, "Johnny, you know I hate the death penalty. I wish we didn't have it." But the case was so bad, they said, "You kill these assholes for what they did." And that is what happens with the country. They don't like it until they know what happened, and then they need it in certain cases, and they're going to be limited.
Well, all right, very, very helpful. Thank you. Dave, give me a couple minutes.
Well, I hope people will entertain the thought that to say that there are some people who deserve the most severe punishment doesn't say anything one way or the other about whether that should be the death penalty. We're the only democracy that still uses it in the West, and the countries that don't use it have far fewer murders than us. In England and France and Germany, a horrible crime elicits the reaction, yes, he should get the maximum. But that doesn't tell you what the maximum is. And with all the problems and the costliness and the delay and the uncertainty of the death penalty, I think it really is time for a sort of cool reappraisal, just from a policy point of view, of whether the death penalty as that worst punishment has outlived its utility and needs to be looked at again.
Gotcha. Well, gentlemen, very, very appreciative of your comments. I mean, I have a script in front of me where we could fill at least another 4 hours. We won't be doing that. But I know, Kayla, I think you've been tracking questions. And so maybe we can see if there's any questions from our viewing audience that we can address.
Sure. There's a couple in the Q&A feature that may be the...
Yeah, let me take a quick peek. Hold on. There is a question that's kind of a very interesting kind of practical question. And this goes back to a fight that was happening within, I think, the Obama administration and Loretta Lynch at some point. The question is, what about the availability or lack thereof of drugs used for lethal injection as a cause for fewer executions? And I don't know if you guys kind of were around for this stretch, but there was a period of time where the Attorney General was not certifying the cocktails that are used in the carrying out of the execution. And that was effectively like a pocket moratorium for a while. But is that an issue that any of you guys have lived with recently?
Well, it's become less of an issue. There seem to be more workarounds for states that want to use the death penalty. What this really reflects, I think, more deeply is an uneasy conscience about the whole business and looking for a way of killing people that looks like a medical procedure. The real cruelty of the death penalty, if you look at it that way, is not the method that's used, but the idea of executing someone by the calendar and then by the clock. And that's like nothing else that happens in the world. And there's no drug or procedure that does anything about that.
It is interesting. I mean, I know there was actually litigation where advocates that were against the death penalty were actually suing the drug manufacturers as a way of stopping this chain. That contributed to this need for new cocktails and the issue of validating it by the Attorney General. It was kind of an interesting backdoor way to get to execution. It probably in some ways explains this tiny resurgence of firing squads as an actual manner of execution, which strikes me as, you know, I feel like I'm watching the History Channel when you start talking about something that's kind of dated like that. But in some ways, perhaps it's less cruel if some of the kind of anecdotal information about cocktails not serving the right effect are true, then perhaps that's a better way. I mean, again, we could have a very lengthy and macabre conversation about the actual death, the manner of death. And there was a question that came in that said that, are there any thoughts about state legislation abolishing the death penalty as in Ohio? And of course, I'm a Marylander. We haven't had the death penalty for a while, but I guess my question to bootstrap to that, do any of you think that as perhaps more states abolish the death penalty, that that'll have any effect on the federal prosecution? Or as I think we saw with the Feld case back in the day, Vermont was saying, we don't do the death penalty, we never have. And the heads of the Department of Justice at that time said, well, welcome to the rest of America, you're going to do one. Do you guys think there's any impact on the current administration of states abolishing the death penalty?
I don't think on this administration. They've made their preference for their belief in the death penalty extraordinarily clear. But, you know, federalism oftentimes seems to be something that switches on and off depending on whose ox is being gored. Criminal law is supposed to be primarily a state responsibility. And this used to be a conservative view. And I really wonder the idea that the federal government should step in and by the decisions of a single government functionary behind a desk in Washington overrule effectively the judgment of the democratically elected state governments about whether the death penalty should be carried out in that jurisdiction doesn't strike me as a very conservative or states' rights approach, even though, of course, there's, you know, they can do it. They have the power to do it. But is that the way we should be going?
Johnny, let me throw this question at you, because I do know we have very little time left or almost out. Some state legislatures are creating escape hatches for people sentenced with life without parole. Federally, there's actually some statutory authority for people that are ill or on their dying stages to be released. Do you think that undercuts the ability to argue that life without parole is an effective alternative to the death penalty? And that'll be our last question since it's 1 o'clock.
I think it does. I never liked life without parole because first of all, I don't think we could actually carry it out, because I don't think we're going to keep people in prison when they're on a dialysis machine when they're 90 years old, and they're just not going to pay for that. So I would prefer to have the death penalty on the cases that matter, and then some kind of life 35 or life 40, where you've got to do 40 calendar years before you're eligible for parole. So you're going to be in your 60s when you're looking at it. And then even then, if the crime is so bad, you still may stay in. So I'm not fond of that. And I just, you know, when we're flying around in spaceships 50 years from now, I just don't think we're going to keep 90-year-olds that we promised back in 2025 we were going to keep in prison until they died. I don't think we can keep that promise, because I think future politicians will not fulfill it because they're not going to pay for it.
Yeah, it's an expensive promise. Well, I want to thank you guys for really making this a very thoughtful and helpful and intelligent conversation. And I'll turn it over to Kayla to wrap things up. But again, thanks. And I'm sure a lot of the viewers feel exactly the same way.
I'll echo those thanks. Really appreciate you all taking this section of your days and sharing your expertise and insight. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. Welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.